Today we're going to talk about Chinese history in South Africa. We're going to talk to a guy, among others, we've got two guests who are popping by, but Mr. Walter Pon is a third generation South African born Chinese. It is time for episode 2 of How's It China?
This is How's It China with Clip Central and China Plus. Download the podcast on the Clip Central website, app, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We're going to talk to Professor Catherine Munro, who is the chairman of the Johannesburg Heritage Foundation and an honorary associate professor at Wits University School of Architecture and Planning. And as I mentioned, Mr. Walter Pon, a third generation South African-born Chinese. We'll talk to them about the history of Chinese people in South Africa and all the interesting things associated with that. Professor Munro, what a pleasure to meet you. How are you?
Thank you. Well, thanks.
Very, very good.
Great to be with you.
So Johannesburg has all these layers, like an onion, and you peel off the layers and you find more, and there's so much interesting stuff going on. The history of the Chinese people in South Africa is a fascinating discussion, all on its own, and Pumi and I thought we would get you in studio to talk to you a little bit about this morning. What can you tell us about the origins of the story of China and South Africa?
Well, the great draw card was indeed gold.
Yes.
Everybody came to Johannesburg in the earliest of days because of gold. There was the anticipation that there would be this gold mountain. And of course, very often people didn't know whether they were going to be coming to San Francisco and California or coming to Johannesburg. And so you did have everybody being attracted, and the Chinese were simply one of the nationalities, and that was the earliest origins of Chinese people who put down deep and long-term roots, as did other immigrant communities from the 1880s, 1890s. But of course, from the very earliest date, they did face considerable prejudice.
Sure, as many groups in South Africa did, right?
And they had to then accommodate themselves. But the Chinese then did settle in Ferreira's town. And what's remarkable about the Chinese is that the first Chinatown is still there in Ferreira's town. Take yourself down the bottom end of Commissioner Street.
Right.
And you will find those traces. It's not a very large community. It isn't like, I mean, I always got associations with Los Angeles,
yeah,
or San Francisco. Very much bigger and more prominent Chinatowns there. But incredibly, Johannesburg has two Chinatowns, a more recent Chinatown, which has developed since 1994 in Cyril Dean, down Derrick
right.
Avenue.
Yes, of course.
Completely different community, different roots. And as Walter will tell you, and as he's just walked in.
Yep. Morning, Mr. Pon. How are you?
Hi, morning.
Very nice
morning,
to see you. We're welcoming you and Professor Munro here this morning to talk to us about all of this interesting stuff. So you were saying, as he will no doubt testify.
That in fact there are different components, and of course the Chinese presence in South Africa is also a reflection of what was happening in China. Why did people come here? Because they hoped for a better life at different points in time.
Right.
But South Africa then had official, remember this in our histories, had official connection with Taiwan.
That's right.
That was, there's this difference between communist China and nationalist China. And that presence in China was recognized as Taiwan for many years.
That's right.
But it's been since 1994 that the recognition has switched to mainland China. And the connections have very considerably strengthened with literally hundreds of thousands of Chinese. Where's your old Chinese community comprised? How many people, Walter?
Dwindling, dwindling, dwindling. Mm.
Really? Mm. Tiny numbers.
Probably nearer to 6,000 to 7,000.
Wow, really?
The tiny proportion.
You're looking at a few hundred thousand of more recent Chinese.
Right.
You know, Professor Munro, I think a couple of years ago was the first time that I realized that Chinese people in South Africa were also classified as non-white. When the first Cecil Share offering was done, because they were included in that share offering. And
yes,
then
we were.
And for the first time realized that Chinese people in South Africa also had this lesser status, even though a lot of them came here looking for a better life.
Right. The Chinese people did face considerable disadvantages and were regarded as Asiatics, along with Indian people. So often Indian people combined with Chinese interests. Mm. It's quite interesting that Gandhi, in his struggle for human rights in 1907, when you had the issues of registration and what do you do about bringing wives across and what do you do about opening businesses and you have to have your fingerprints taken and you need to carry a pass, right? All of these factors were issues around which both Chinese and Indian concerns coalesced and became politicized. And initially it was Gandhi taking on what was then the Transvaal government, because again there's all these layers of history, who's actually in charge, and the anticipation was that when South Africa became a union of the four provinces, that there would be dispensations, recognitions, an easier situation. That didn't happen until, and this was where Gandhi developed his passive resistance approach.
Mr. Pan, I'm fascinated by the fact that you were actually born in Sophia Town.
Yes, born and bred South African.
Born and bred South African.
Who was the first of your ancestors to come here? Your grandfather?
My grandfather came here before the Boer War.
Wow. Okay, so you
that's a long history.
So you, I mean, you're South African then through and through in terms of like three generations of presence here. But tell me about how that experience has changed for Chinese South Africans over the years.
But funny thing though, my grandfather came here in spite of him coming here. If it wasn't for the Japanese War, we probably wouldn't be here in South Africa.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
why? Because in the 1937-38, my father had his own school in Canton.
Oh yeah.
No, he's academic. So is my mother, and so he had his own school until the Japanese came, and of course they had to run for their lives, throwing bombs and so on.
And they decided to come here.
Well, then because my grandfather was here, he had message that, I don't know, even in spite of the great distance, he got message that Pretoria's Chinese school was looking for a teacher and principal. Then he said, well, why don't he apply? And he got the job.
And then that brought them back. But
yes.
I mean, that's interesting. So there was always this connection between China and here. And your father and mother were actually in China, but then decided to come and rejoin your grandfather.
Yes, yes.
And your experience then of growing up in South Africa during the time that Professor Munro and Pumi are talking about now, where there was a system of classification of people, and Chinese people were considered non-white and therefore had a different set of rules and laws applied to them. I mean, do you remember any of that from your youth?
Course, let's put it straight. We are non-whites, okay?
Yeah.
But in the classification, they have different class of non-whites. We had a little bit better, maybe we're a small in number, but on the other hand, the blacks probably had heard the worst of it, and so did the Indians and coloureds. We, I think, because of a smaller number, socially we were very much accepted in the bigger cities.
Oh, wow.
But not in Pretoria. Pretoria is where predominantly Afrikaners were.
And there was more discrimination there?
Oh, very much, very much.
What was the Chinese community like at the time when you were a teenager?
Well, to start off with, you can't go to a white school until the Catholics under Bishop Boyd and Father Tui decide we must have the Chinese. They broke the law and admitted the Chinese. Mm-hmm. So the convents accepted the girls, and the Maris brothers, Sacred Heart now, they took on the boys. And even though they were threatened for closing the shop, closing the school, they decided to take on us.
Wow. What was the primary business of most people in the Chinese community at that
stage? Well, at the time, the 90% or even 95% all had shops.
Shops.
Yes.
Because as Professor Munro said earlier, the allure of mining was what brought so many here, but then ultimately they ended up settling into other areas of industry.
Well, actually, sorry, Professor, you want to tell us about mining?
Yes.
Yes, go ahead.
I think we do have to make a distinction between the Chinese people who came and indeed opened shops and tried to develop a normal life, this is what happened, and hence the origins of Chinatown. And then that period, a very curious period, from 1903 to roughly 1910, when the mining industry, after the Anglo-Boer War, decided to import Chinese laborers as though they were a commodity. And this was to get the mines going again after the Anglo-Boer War, and this was spearheaded by Rand Mines, Herman Eckstein and Company, and it was 1903-1904. It required considerable, you can imagine, agreement all round. You had to have recruiters going out into China and recruiting men, and they brought in something like 60,000 Chinese laborers. But these people, because that was an episode, and they were then repatriated, particularly as it became a political issue. Although today everybody thinks, aha, the Chinese miners are important, and you see they were rather exotic, and you see them in early postcards, and this has been revived and brought about quite a lot of interest. These people made a very important but a temporary contribution to South Africa's economic revival, and did not then put down roots. Maybe one or two escaped the rules and having to go back by ship and so on. But you can say as a whole, it wasn't a permanent presence in China from that group. You've got to go back earlier or later to look for the Chinese who came to South Africa and became South Africa.
And settled here.
But I think the one thing that is so distinct about Chinese culture is anywhere you go around the world, it's so well preserved within that community. And even here in South Africa, when you do go down to Chinatown, my son and I go down there, Chinese New Year, we go down there, fireworks, and the restaurants, obviously, but it's so well preserved. And also when you go to Seraldine, it's like a little China in the middle of Seraldine. It's how
has its a character all of its own, right?
How
and we know Johannesburg is an interesting place, but really that these...
I think it adds to the interest of Johannesburg.
Absolutely.
Yeah, how does the community do that?
Walter, haven't you been called the unofficial mayor of Chinatown?
Yeah, that is so. That's what I'm known as. Going back to the miners, there's two points I'd like to make. I believe they saved the mining industry because at that time, nobody was prepared to work. So someone got a very clever idea. Why don't you bring in the Chinese? They are hardworking, and true, of course. But the people who came from China, from Shandong, those are the big, tall, strong ones. Not like a southerners. And they came over here. Most of them all went back. In fact, it was contract workers, so they should have all went back. But like Professor said, some did manage to escape, and I believe they got assimilated with the blacks and colors, because in that era of time, there were hardly many Chinese around anyway.
That's interesting.
They were a distinct group of people, and they did, even as miners, preserve their own culture. They were interested in Chinese medicine, in Chinese opera. This is mine workers putting on an opera, celebrating the Chinese New Year. These are all things that we have captured in images of the time. But it was also a shock. Very often, as they were large men, they were expecting to work on open cast mines. Coal mining had been their experience. There had been Chinese indentured laborers going into Russia. Now, that's the background. When they came to South Africa, You go for underground mining.
Deep in the belly.
And that's a very different story. You need sophisticated technology and also a great deal of muscle power.
And much smaller people.
Not necessarily. No. But you certainly needed men prepared to work hard. A lot of hard physical labor involved in extracting the rock containing the mine ore and crushing it. And that was a process that took place. And it did happen over several years. And they made a very important contribution.
I hear that they were very... living conditions were very poor.
Yeah.
And they suffered tremendously.
Mm. Funds were then remitted to their families in China. That was part of the deal. Mm. In that way. Of course, politically, this was considered to be, is this such a smart idea to bring in another group of people? You'd had Indian indentured laborers who'd settled as a result of the sugar plantations. Now you're adding another mix of laborers in large numbers. Do you really want this to happen? And so it became a political issue, and ultimately it brought about the fall of the Campbell-Bannerman government in England in 1906, and the Transvaal regains its independence, and they say, nope, okay, Chinese labourers, end of that experiment. It's an experiment, in inverted commas, and we're going to find another way. And, of course, they were did indeed go for recruiting black labourers right throughout southern Africa, as far as Malawi.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That was the organization of the Witwatersrand Native Recruitment Labor Organization. Mm-hmm. It was and of course, you know, you brought in mine laborers from all over Africa.
Well, while we're talking about geography, I just want to ask Walter, where else in South Africa are there concentrations of Chinese population?
Besides Johannesburg, would be Port Elizabeth.
Oh, really?
Oh, really?
Yes. Port Elizabeth. In comparison to the population in Port Elizabeth, they are big numbers, big percentage.
Is there a historical reason
for that?
Is it perhaps because it was just a port city? And I mean, I would expect Durban to have done the same.
Something I never got into.
I think that Durban was far less hospitable when you think about its Indian background. Port Elizabeth was a welcoming place. I have a Chinese friend whose grandmother recalled landing in Port Elizabeth and being surprised that she had to walk an awful long way she'd come as a bride in the 1920s from China.
Important.
And that was the start of that particular Chinese family.
We're talking about Durban, sorry. Funny though, of all the population, Joburg and Pretoria were often very similar. But they come from Pretoria, Joburg, wherever they can find a shop. But Port Elizabeth, next population. Durban, very small. Cape Town, very small. So it's concentrated mainly in Witwatersrand and then Port Elizabeth. At Durban, they use it as stepping. They get off Durban and they all come to Joburg.
Sure. And growing up here in South Africa, you were still very much, you've kept your traditions, kept the identity of being a Chinese person. How does the Chinese community get that right? What is it that they get right in making sure that they're able to preserve their culture but also pass it on to the next generation?
Well, on that part, I would say partly is due to the apartheid laws because they encouraged people to stick to themselves. So we had no choice.
So apartheid laws made it almost created like a bubble.
Well, what happened is here, they encouraged everybody to stick to themselves.
Mm.
So you have the blacks to themselves, the colors to themselves, Indian to themselves, and Chinese. We didn't have an area, all right? But so lots of us had shops in the black areas, Cryptown, Alexander, Sapphire Town, New Clare.
Hmm.
My grandfather had a shop in La Rochelle, and there were quite a few Chinese in the southern suburbs there, Rosettenville, La Rochelle, Tiffentine. I remember there were quite a few Chinese shops there. In fact, my memory serves me, most of the shops in an era were probably owned by Chinese shops in the white suburbs.
Wow. So I mean, from a commercial point of view, probably was a bit of an arterial system. I mean, in terms of trade, because Johannesburg's only 100 years old, and for those shops to have been established at the beginning of the last century, they must have had a big impact on trade and on general commerce in the area.
I think it broadens the range of goods that's available. I think that it was also Chinese people and their shops were very competitive. We do see this again today. This is still happening. You have interesting goods being sold of all kinds. I own, and I showed Walter this piece of furniture, a Chinese kist made out of cedar wood, magnificently carved. It
hand
was
carved.
A wedding gift to my mother-in-law in 1938. And it's still in our family, and it's still a much-loved possession. And it was, I think, one of the objects that got me interested in collecting beautiful Chinese things. And so I've always been in love with Chinese ceramics, porcelain, carvings, cloisonne, jewelry, jade. There's such a rich culture that is expressed physically in the objects that have come to us.
I think this is wonderful.
Professor, you're talking of the camphor kiss, porcelain, figurines, Chinese vase, the one you had in your house, the cloisonne. That's something which we used to have two or three shops in Johannesburg selling to the whites.
That was probably where they bought those.
They love it.
Now, your family business is still going.
Yes.
This is now third generation of the business as well.
My parents started in 1943.
Yes, but I mean, effectively, your grandfather was also a shopkeeper, so you could claim that it was three generations of business.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Well, he's a different. He had a grocery shop.
Okay.
We had a gift shop.
That's amazing.
So I do, though, want to share with our listeners Walter's vision, which I fully support as Johannesburg Heritage, and that is that we should together develop a memorial garden, a museum that people can enjoy down in First Chinatown. There's a great opportunity. There's a lot of land that has not been used, but there are also streets that are no longer being used. And we would love to see a museum developed as a memorial garden, recalling all the elements and components of the Chinese presence and history in South Africa and those important ties between China in its various dimensions and South Africa.
Well, why don't you, Walter, just tell us about some of the people who've been such an important part of Johannesburg history. I believe that you are trying to commemorate the history of the Chinese in South Africa, and you've got a list of people and a number of episodes in our history which are worth telling stories about. I mean, give us some idea of this, even if it's just one or two people.
Well, there's a certain in those days, Chinese being segregated, we were a very close community. We were not open to the outside society besides ourselves. Well, there were very little contact outside the Chinese community. As a result, we had lots of problems. Business, for example. In the old days, commissioner and ilo, for example, is the place. Okay, if you want to buy a shop or rent a shop there, no go.
Yeah, so you couldn't go into the obvious areas.
No. So, but subsequently, then they decide to give us a permit. But that permit doesn't come by easily. Now, if you want to buy a property or rent a property, you have to apply for a permit. It can take months, even a year. Now, no landlord's prepared to, even though you're prepared to pay the rent for it, wants an empty shop for that length of period of time. So that fell away. We were discriminated. Hospitals. It was only after various incidents. Now, you're talking about a person the Chinese consulate in those days, China, South Africa didn't recognize Communist China. Mm-hmm. For that matter, Communist China, after, I'm talking about the early 50s and so on.
Right.
It was the Republic of China.
That's right.
Now, just to go back a little bit, Republic of China came along in 1912. Mm-hmm. All right. Then the World War and the Civil War. 1949, the Communists took over, and Republic of China, as Professor called it, Taiwan, went to Taiwan, Formosa, Taiwan. And now our community here had lots to do with the Consul General and subsequently the embassy. We had to rely on them to go to the government to fight for our rights and so on. Now, they did lots and lots for us. If it wasn't for them, we wouldn't have achieved what we had then. Take going to the hospital, for example. I remember my, all the times for the matter, you had, if you want hospital, you're either private or you go to coronation. Well, maybe Baragwana, but mainly coronation. So where the standard of medicine, very poor. Doctors, very, very ordinary and very poor.
Yes.
So we suffered a lot. It was only after there was an incident where a Chinese guy had ride a motorbike, which I'll call a two-wheeler coffin. He had an accident, and someone called an ambulance. A white ambulance came along. The guy said, no, he's a non-white. So he went back and called the black one. A black ambulance came along. He says, no, he's not black. So this poor guy lying in the street, and no one take care of him.
My God.
Now, there were many similar instances of this sort, and then subsequently, a Chinese consul on our behalf protest. Okay, they say, okay, you can go to General Hospital, but quietly in the corner. Okay,
don't make noise. Okay, still keep it quiet.
So we had a private ward of our own, and you keep quietly in the corner, and that's. And then, of course, an incident about going into public places like cinema. Swimming pool, rather.
Oh, yes.
Talking of cinemas, because we are in Johannesburg, I remember I went to the Colosseum, Metro, Empire, no problem. Mm.
But swimming pools, no.
No, no. Socially, we very much accepted, even, I remember, nightclubs and so on. There was no problem.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the bigger cities, but not in the smaller places. Pretoria, no go. Take Pretoria, for example. Where does Andre White came along with? Japan in those days had a lot of business with South Africa, mm-hmm. iron ore and so on. So because they were temporary here, they were given white status. Now this Japanese guy, the Japanese person went to ride a tram or bus, whatever, and he was kicked off.
Sure.
And of course, Japanese consulate
protested.
And then they say, well, how do I know whether he's a Japanese or Chinese? So that was one of the reasons, I believe, that was one of the reasons why we were given, the Chinese from then onwards had enjoyed the little status.
Oh, wow.
So because of more racism, you ended up with less.
But you could get on the tram. It's quite an extraordinary concept to be called an honorary what?
Isn't it ridiculous? I mean, you think about it now, this really is just madness. Now, what about the current community here in South Africa? And you mentioned Cyril Dean earlier, which is a very vibrant neighborhood. There's a lot going on there. As Pumi says, it's a great place to be for Chinese New Year. There's some marvelous restaurants. There's some terrific places to go and visit. But what is the differentiating factor now? And if you compare it historically, Professor, with the kind of Chinatown that we had in the beginning in Ferreira's Dorp. What's the main difference?
I think different languages, Cantonese, Mandarin, the longer routes, the South African identity.
Yeah.
The older Chinese people are South African.
Mm.
The newer Chinese people, perhaps not quite so much. It's going to take them another generation. Although, of course, we see this presence in the Oriental City, which we have down at Bruma, for example. I was there a few weeks ago and was buying some lovely Chinese beads, and the mother couldn't speak English. but the daughter could, and she was heading for UCT. She got a place to study medicine.
Have the
and
puns
got
another?
That's going to make for integration.
Have the puns got another generation coming? That are here in South Africa?
Unfortunately not.
Have they gone elsewhere?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh. That, of course, is, again, part of everybody becoming worldwide citizens.
Absolutely.
If you have the education, and I think the Chinese, part of preserving their culture has been the emphasis on education. If you have education, you're actually equipping yourself to move everywhere. And there is a brain drain from Africa. Because of this now, we're seeing this repeat racism in another direction.
Yeah,
to say, well, maybe you're not quite so welcome.
Yeah.
And people, yes, of course, people think in a self-interested way because it's about preservation of themselves and their families.
Yeah.
And I think that is regrettable because I believe that we can make something of South Africa into the future. If we accept that so many different cultures have a contribution to make.
What do you think the major contribution has been of the Chinese community to South Africa and vice versa? What has South Africa contributed to you and to your family? And what do you think that overlap is in terms of a value exchange?
Well, mainly the contribution that China's made here would mainly be in the trade. Take right up to the 80s, then the Taiwan came around, Taiwanese came around,
mm-hmm.
opened over 260-something factories. Can you imagine opening 265 factories, the goods they produce for local consumption mm-hmm. and even for mm-hmm. exporting? And some even came over here for a reason. When you're in Hong Kong and China, I believe you can't export things to the States and other countries easily. Whereas they come over here and open a factory, it's mainly South Africa. So along those lines, in that period of time, Taiwanese did very well.
And massive industries.
Yes.
The contribution, too, has come in opening South Africa to the possibilities of importing commodities from China in a competitive way, sharpening South Africa's own competitive drive.
Absolutely.
In manufacturing. Thinking about, well, how have the Chinese succeeded so well with sustaining those high growth rates in a communist system that since 1949 and now has adapted through the years, and that they have had this industrialization drive which becomes a model for South Africa. So I think trade has been important. I think investment in factories, I think too in education. There has been a model here. The fact that you have an extremely cultured, literate community that prides itself on ensuring that their children are educated in schools and overcoming all the difficulties of segregation.
And speaking of schools, I mean, your dad came to teach at the Chinese school in Pretoria, but we also have a Chinese school here in Johannesburg.
Well, on this point here, my father was Pretoria school.
Mm.
My mother was Johannesburg Chinese school.
Oh, wow.
Until they decided to open Su Ying Hong. That's the business, family business.
Right. Mm-hmm. But there is...
There's still a Chinese school in Johannesburg.
Unfortunately, no.
No.
Oh, the only school we have are what we call the weekend Chinese schools.
Well, to tell the story of the Chinese school, because I'm fascinated.
All right, going back to the trade, what contribution, we'll go back to school in a minute. Talking of the contribution, the trade, Taiwanese came open factories, then in the 90s, and the flood of the mainland Chinese came. Real flood. For whatever reason, they came over here for greener pastures, and they all did well. To start off with, they were selling in the streets. In those days, it was very peaceful, and there was no problem as far as crime. Minimal. Mm. There's crime all the time, but minimal. They sold their wares. They brought the Chinese goods from China. They had that direct access to it, mm-hmm. and they were selling the streets. Of course, the blacks weren't very happy because that's traditionally that's where they sell.
Yeah.
But then, of course, we had problems there as well too because they were competing, And then that was the beginning of it. Then they slowly found out, wow, we're doing well here. But why selling the shops? Why not in the shops? Selling the street is so inconvenient. You've got to move the... All right, we have good weather here, but you can do so much and no more.
You have to pack up every day.
Yes.
Every night.
So they decide to open the shop. Then this is where the beginning of the malls coming along.
Mm.
Now, presently there's probably about half a dozen of these malls. Majority is all manned by the Chinese. And all of a sudden, all Chinese were importers. In those days, in the early days, about 50s, 60s, there was only 3-4 of us importing Chinese goods. Because in those days, there was a restriction importing goods, what they call import permit. And not everybody can import goods as freely as they would like to. So between the 3-4 of us, we had a monopoly. Until when it opened up, the black government took over, then... I wouldn't say we went out of business. All of a sudden we had lots of competition because every Chinese shopkeeper was importing goods.
Right. Mm. So suddenly it was much more evenly distributed.
Yes, and not only that. In those days, you won't find any Chinese in Free State because in the previous government, Free State was a no-go.
That's right. The Free State banned all Indian and Chinese people from ever settling there, right?
There was only one guy.
These peculiar...
There was only one guy.
Yes, one family there. Why? One family, he was a kung fu expert. So they needed him, and he was stationed in Cecilburg. He taught the police kung fu.
We don't want Chinese people here, but we want your kung fu.
But the one guy, yeah.
We want your kung fu.
Yes, I think, too, South Africans have come to be much more accepting, more open, more knowledgeable about what China has to offer. I do think films and the martial arts taught us a great deal about the rest of the world, the opportunity to travel. I think the world is open to South Africa, and as a result, there has been a greater acceptance. Mm-hmm. I do think the Chinese in South Africa, the next generation, are simply South Africans. Mm-hmm. They do all sorts, journalists, mm-hmm. accountants, mm-hmm. doctors. The emphasis has been the route to personal development through education, mm-hmm. which is a great...
Prof, you talked about Kung Fu. I read with interest last week. Okay, maybe it was due to Councillor Michael Soon. He's our President of Johannesburg. What do they call him?
Consul General.
No. He's MMC for...
Oh, yes.
Safety.
That's right.
Michael,
yes.
Michael's son.
Yes.
Okay,
yeah. He pronounces Soon.
Soon.
Yes. He's in charge of the police and ambulance.
Yes, safety.
Yes, and he, together with embassy, brought in some Kung Fu instructors. Did you read the newspaper last week? Teaching the police
that's
what
fantastic.
To do. Now, this is without weapons, right? When you're confronted, how do you tackle them?
Right.
Now, talking of Kung Fu, then, this is by the way, this was paid for all by the Chinese government.
Wow.
You can see the closeness.
That's amazing. Mm.
You see the trade has brought over, like I was saying, every shop its own or run by the Chinese in the various malls. Until recent development, things hasn't been going so smoothly. The rate of exchange for the Chinese renminbi, the Chinese yuan, has gone very bad or very good, depends which way you look at it. So a few years ago, when what attracted the Chinese coming over here, I believe the Chinese, I'm talking about mainland China now, it numbered something like 300 to 350,000.
Wow, it's a lot of people.
Yes.
It's an influx.
This, from there onwards, you'll find every little dopey, as we call it,
has a
will
shop.
Have Chinese shops.
That's amazing.
In fact, I once went to a friend of mine. They had a farm, her wedding. They had a farm in the western area.
Mm-hmm.
And they tell me that the family butcher is Chinese and the family hardware store is Chinese. So they are any and everywhere. And I believe you're going to Free State. Every little town there are Chinese shopkeepers.
freedom came for all of us in 1990.
Eventually, yeah, it took a while. Well, Prof, thank you so much. Walter, thank you so much for joining us this morning. It's our second episode of How's It China? You can join us next week for more, and we hope that this has given you some insight into the Chinese community and their presence in South Africa, their history here. And thank you both for...
Go and check it out. I mean, in old Chinatown, there are actually plugs on some of the streets.
You're talking of a new year.
Some of the history.
You're talking of a new year. If you want lots of restaurants, you must go to 13 Chinatown. But if you go for fireworks, you must come down to the first Chinatown.
Absolutely. That's where you can follow the dragon.
Best fireworks shop.
Mm-hmm. And yes, we do have some blue plaques explaining Chinese history, which is Johannesburg Heritage and the city of Joburg backing these, done in First Chinatown. Mm-hmm. And
the great restaurant.
Yes.
Great restaurant. Yes, we spoke a little bit about food with Jen Su last week.
We haven't talked about food.
Week with Jen Su, but in Ferreirsdorp, just around the corner from John Foster Square.
Wow. In fact, that first Chinatown was my suggestion. Because I said, there's Chinatown here, there, and everywhere. But this is, I didn't like the idea of calling it old, even though it's old.
Old Chinatown.
Old have the concept of being drab. Maybe it is to a certain degree.
First, I like that.
First Chinatown is a brilliant idea.
You now have two places that you have to visit in Johannesburg. And thank you both so much. And thank you, Pums. We will be back with How's It China Episode 3 next week.
This is How's It China with Cliff Central and China Plus. Download the podcast on the Cliff Central website, app, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.